Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The next case on our calendar today is A21-1617, consolidated with A21-1683, in the matter of the welfare of the child of DMP and JTP. We are hearing this case by Zoom today, as you're well aware. Appellant's counsel will have 15 minutes collectively for your oral argument. It's your initial argument. It's my understanding that counsel have decided to split your time equally, so you'll each have 7.5 minutes for your initial argument. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes.
And have you made any decision about rebuttal argument?
No, we have not yet.
Would you like my to split? Go ahead.
My plan there, Your Honor, was in the event that I would have any time left over.
Okay, well, you'll have collectively 5 minutes for rebuttal, so the two of you can decide how you want to split that prior to rebuttal. And then, of course, respondent will have 15 minutes for your argument. We are also, just in terms of timing, you should be able to see a timer in the grid view that will show you how much time. For appellants, the marshal will set the timer for 7.5 minutes for each attorney for your initial arguments. And then respondent, you'll have the 15 minutes, of course, for your argument. And then also, just for those of you viewing, I'll ask that you be aware that no recording of our oral arguments is permitted except with the express prior permission of the Court of Appeals. We are, however, recording this oral argument, and it will be available. The audio recording will be available on our website within a day or two. So with that, counsel for appellant, which Mr. Dodd, are you going first? Is that correct?
That's the plan, Your Honor.
Okay. So you can proceed when you're ready, and I'll ask each attorney to please introduce yourself and the party you represent at the beginning of your argument.
Very well. Thanks, Your Honor. May I proceed?
You may. Thank you.
Thank you. good morning again. My name is Timothy Dodd. I'm here today on behalf of the appellant, initials JTP, who's the father of the child involved in this child protection termination of parental rights case. As the court, I'm sure, is aware, this case is comes before the court, and it involves the statutory presumption of palpable unfitness that arises whenever a parent has a prior involuntary termination of parental rights. And my client in this case does have an involuntary prior termination of parental rights going back to 2013. What I think is a problem, a very basic problem with the trial court's decision in this case, we start with the proposition that the trial court does not mention the decision in the matter of the welfare of the child of RBL, which is a Supreme Court case, 853 Northwest 2nd, 127, which means that the trial court didn't apply what I think the law now requires with respect to how this presumption is going to be, dealt with.
Mr. Dodd, excuse me for interrupting. I am having a little bit of trouble hearing you, and I'm not sure if the other judges are too. Yeah, it looks like they are. So if you can maybe speak a little more loudly into your headset, we would appreciate it. Thank you.
Can you hear me okay now?
Yes, much better. Thank you.
Okay. I'll try to keep my voice voice at this level. But anyways, what I was the point that I was making is that because the trial court did not deal with the RDL decision, didn't mention it, and then the subsequent decision in the JAK matter, which is cited in the materials, the court touched on that, but doesn't really address the issues that need to be addressed under RDL and JAK, and I think where the trial court went wrong is I think those cases, especially RDL, represents a departure from what the law had been. And I think it, as noted in the that footnote one in the JAK decision, some of the decisions and specifically the language the trial court relied on has been called into question by the RDL and JAK decisions. And the importance of it is I think significant, in as much as the RDL case was a constitutional case, constitutional challenge to the statute on the grounds that it violated equal protection, and the manner in which the Supreme Court dealt with that and held that it was constitutional hinged on the court finding that the statutory presumption was easily rebuttable. In this case, the trial court doesn't mention that it's easily rebuttable. Instead, it referred to old language, which required the parents to affirmatively and actively demonstrate the changes that they had made in order to rebut the presumption. And that's just not the way it is under current law, at least as I read. And so what we have here, take a look at the case of my client. In 2013, he was determined to be palpably unfit. And what's happened is, based on that finding of palpable unfitness, he's being deprived 9 years later of an opportunity to parent his child. In our brief, I've offered I think a substantial amount, described a substantial amount of evidence that was offered on behalf of my client in connection with what he's done since 2013. Among other things, he successfully worked a case plan. That seems like evidence. In 2018, he successfully worked a case plan in Dr. County, which seems like evidence of some ability to parent. In addition to that, in both of his prior cases, his 2013 and 2018 cases, alcohol abuse was a factor. He was needing to address. By the time of the 2021 case, that was not even seen by the agency as an issue in the case. And his testimony was that he had that he abstained from alcohol. And there was no evidence. There was no evidence to the contrary. Another thing that the trial court. One of the concerns that has been raised about my client is his history of domestic violence, and he definitely has that history. he offered some testimony, and that was not contradicted by his probation agent, that he'd completed anger management and domestic violence program. but the point is, in the current relationship between these parents, there isn't any domestic violence. There's no evidence of any domestic violence in that relationship. So at least to that extent, maybe both of these parents have made some changes made some of the changes that they needed to make.
Also, with regard to your client, in paragraph 32 of the district court's conclusions of law, the district court references some recent criminal charges and seems to rely on that and then reaching its conclusion. Was that appropriate in your view?
I don't think it was inappropriate, perhaps, for the court to consider the evidence. I'm not sure that it has much bearing on the case at hand. That, as I understand the allegations of that case, first of all, is at the time of trial, that matter was still pending and may still be pending. I'm not sure. But it wasn't a domestic. It was an allegation of an argument with a neighbor that resulted in my client being charged, I think, with maybe a fifth degree assault, a disorderly conduct, or both. I don't know exactly what the charges were. The other thing that happened in this case, which I think has an important bearing on the question of the domestic violence, is according to the testimony, there was to be a parental capacity evaluation in this case. In fact, it was pending at the time.
So, counsel, your time is actually up.
Forgive me.
Okay, thank you. All right, then, Ms. Walker, you can proceed when you're ready. I think you're on mute, ma'am.
And many of my arguments mirror that of Mr. Dodds in that I do not believe that the district court addressed the level of which my client was to prove her palpable unfitness. And that is an easily rebuttable and a low bar. And the judge did not address either JAK or RDO in his findings. And in this case, particularly when you look at the facts, our client or my client, DMP, was not able to even provide the opportunity to rebut their presumption that she was in the state of Minnesota for all of 6 hours when her son was taken away from her. She went to every meeting. And even though she didn't sign a case plan, she followed all the case plan requirements. She was willing to do a capacity to parent evaluation to prove that her circumstances had changed, and she wasn't even provided that opportunity. She wasn't even allowed 30 days between the date in which her child was taken away to the point in time in which the determination by the county was made to file for a termination. So I ask you if...
Walker, can I just ask sort of a foundational question here?
Sure,
yes. So the argument is that the district court erred in concluding that the presumption had not been rebutted by both parents. Is the argument that the district court made an error of law and failing to apply the correct standard, which I understand you to be arguing is pretty low standard? Or is your argument that the district court erred in its evaluation of the evidence and made an erroneous factual finding?
Thank you for that question, Your Honor. First and foremost, my rebuttal is that the court erred in not following JAK or RDL and making findings in either of those cases. And if you supplant those two cases, it was a low bar for the parents to rebut the presumption of previous terminations. Were the facts was there enough for the court to actually terminate the parental rights of my client as well as Mr. Dodd's client? And I guess, so it's two-tiered. JAK and RDL are very important distinctions in the law of what kind of level or what kind of proof needs to be provided. Does proof need to be provided or do statements need to be provided? And where does the burden shifting take place? And did the county, in fact, provide the appropriate burden shifting evidence? And it seems like a tautonomous argument that if the burden is to be low, that a parent has changed the circumstances in which they were in. And there is no finding as to whether or not the court found specifically that low bar and what evidence was used to get there. And was that used in the determination? Then did the court err or did the county err in not providing anything other than the fact that they had previous terminations? Because they were never given an opportunity to show whether or not their circumstances had changed. And what was that bar? When did it take place? 10 days later, after 6 days, 8 days, 30 days? What is the burden of proof that a parent needs to come with that their lives have indeed changed? And if they're not given the opportunity to provide that evidence, because they're not even given the opportunity to finish their case plans, then what is that burden then that a parent needs to come forth to a district court to show that their circumstances have changed? Other than 6 hours later, their child is taken away and they show up for every single parenting time. They show up for every single involvement and everybody has everything positive to say about these parents. But yet they're not even given the opportunity to show that their lives have changed or that they've met that burden of change. So in the light of JAK and RDL together, did, without the court even taking into consideration that low standard, then the county has the higher burden of showing why these parents need to have these children taken away. So it's a circular argument of, well, you had children taken away. Well, because you had children taken away, therefore you've had you need to have your future children taken away, without the opportunity to show that this low burden has been met and the court hasn't even considered that low burden.
Ms. Walker, in your brief at pages 15 to 16, you discuss what evidence is in the record that you believe rebuts the presumption. It's a slightly different argument than saying you didn't, that your client didn't have an opportunity. You're saying she had enough of an opportunity to present, in your words, substantial evidence that she has changed the circumstances that led to the previous termination. So maybe you can take a minute and address the evidence that is in the record that you think rebuts the presumption here.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that question. So in the limited time that my client was able to show the county that she has changed her circumstances were that, I mean, she was actively pursuing the safety of her children, even in supervised visitation time, even against all odds when she was told that she should not be. And within the limited scope that she was allowed, I mean, she wasn't even allowed to like complete her case plan or complete a capacity of parent evaluation. But in the limited amount of time that she was able to, because the presumption should be low and is low, pursuant to JAK and RDL, she showed that she was very concerned about her child. She was very concerned about his well-being. She showed up at every feeding. She showed up at every time and every moment she was allowed to show up for. She's the one who showed that the car seat was inappropriate for her son. She's the one that showed that he was, in fact, receiving infections on his bottom. She's the one who showed that the bottles he was showing up with were indeed not as clean as they should have been. She was the one showing up saying he was in clothing that was too small. What else in the world could she possibly have done in the limited time she was allowed to do it to show that she is meeting the presumption that she could not care for her child? She did not put him in danger. She never threatened to put him in danger. And the presumption, the previous presumption, was that she was in a very domestically violent situation that exposed her children to that. there is no allegations that she was ever on drugs, alcohol. It's only that she was in a very domestically assaulted situation that she tried to correct. And so she tried to correct them. Granted, she was with a man who had a bad history, but there was no domestic assault between them, nor were they allowed to show that they had amended their previous situations. Or there was no evidence to say that he was domestically assaulted or that she was domestically assaulted. And you can't just take a child away. I mean, there's a presumption that the child should be with their biological parents or biological family.
Ms. Walker, thank you for that helpful answer. Your time has expired. Counsel for appellants will have 5 minutes for rebuttal, and you can maybe email between yourselves right now and decide how you want to split that. All right, counsel for respondent, you can proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Lisa Tufts, Assistant Becker County Attorney, and I represent respondents, Becker County Human Services, in this matter. I would like to address some of Mr. Dodd's concerns first, and I think the overriding question here is the RDO and or RDL and JAK cases that both people have mentioned. And the evidence that was presented to overcome the presumption of palpable unfitness was minute. It may be an easy burden to prove, it may be a low bar, but there was nothing other than the fact that Mr. Payne completed an anger management program after a 2014 conviction. That has not been, there was no evidence supporting that other than Mr. Payne's testimony and the testimony of his probation officer that stated that he assumed it was done because it hasn't been noted that it was not completed, which is not affirmative proof that it was indeed corrected. Secondly,
Ms. Tufts, if I could jump in, there's testimony from, is it Ms. Schermerhorn?
Mm-hmm.
Is that how you pronounce it? There's testimony from Ms. Schermerhorn that the parents, both of them, have, quote, a lot of great parenting skills, that there were no concerns about the day-to-day parenting tasks. So given our case law regarding and describing this low burden, including case law that suggests we don't, that the district court should not consider any or weigh this evidence against any contrary evidence. The burden is one of introduction, and that's it. Isn't Ms. Schermerhorn's statements alone enough to satisfy this low burden of introduction and presumption or production?
I don't believe that it is, Your Honor. And the reason for that, the main reason that this child and Ms. Payne's previous children and Mr. Payne's previous children were ever removed from the home related directly to domestic violence and violence in the home and the trauma that the children had suffered based on that violence. So given the fact that Ms. Schermerhorn said that, yes, they can go to supervised visiting, they can provide bottles, they can complain about the size of the clothes of the child, neither one of them have ever addressed the trauma that a violent home has on a child. Can they do the day-to-day care? Yes, they can feed, they can clothe, they can hold, they can read to the child, but they cannot keep the child from suffering harm based on underlying violence-related issues that they refuse to address.
Counsel, why wasn't the, you know, going back to Judge Bryan's point, that at the initial phase, it's a burden of production in terms of whether the presumption is rebutted. Why wasn't the evidence testimony that Mr. Payne had participated in a program, an anger management program, and completed chemical dependency treatment? Why wasn't that sufficient to address those concerns that you're saying are the underlying concerns that need to be addressed in terms of rebutting the presumption?
Because if Mr. Payne did indeed complete an anger management course programming in 2014, in 2019, after he successfully completed a case plan, which I believe Mr. Dobb referred to, he was charged with a felony domestic assault against the same mother that he had just worked a case plan with.
And who presented that evidence?
The state, the county.
So that shouldn't be then considered in whether he met his burden of production, correct?
I believe that it shows that he has not corrected his anger management problems. He can say that he has, but it is contrary to the conclusion that he has overcome the burden of being a violent person that could have trauma upon the kids.
Did the district court apply the correct standard in determining whether the burden of whether the presumption was rebutted?
I can agree that it probably should have gone with a different standard, that it was easily rebuttable and they would need to provide some evidence. I believe in my brief, let me find the page of that. Actually, it stated that they had to, rebuts a presumption by introducing evidence that would justify a finding of fact that the parent is not palpably unfit. So Mr. Payne saying he went through some anger management programming and then had a subsequent felony domestic violence related conviction 5 years later does not rebut the presumption that he is palpably unfit. And then if we go into JAK and the evidence that she submitted in her case, she had evidence that she had completed counseling. She had her therapist testify that she had recognized the trauma that can be caused for the children based on violence in the home. She went and learned all of those things. In this case, this felony or this family, Mr. and Mrs. Payne, they did nothing. And Becker County Human Services, Ms. Walker went into the fact that she didn't have time to. Right while we were waiting.
Could you turn your video back on, please?
Oh, I'm not sure how it went off.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. Yes. The Becker County Human Services tried to work voluntarily with Ms. Payne during
Ms. Tufts,
pregnancy.
Before switching to Ms. Payne, if I could have you stay with the father here. It seems to me that the logic of the argument from the state is that because of the conviction that is after 2014, that conviction precludes appellant father from being able to rebut the presumption, being able to introduce any evidence that could rebut the presumption. Would you agree that it is the fact of that conviction that you're saying that district court has to consider, and because of that conviction, there's no basis, justifiable basis, to rebut the presumption?
I do believe that, yes, Your Honor, based on the timing of the matter, I would agree that his anger management programming in 2014 was not sufficient to overcome his palpable unfitness when he violently beat the mother of another child of his after he successfully completed a case plan. I think that he could have overcome the presumption by, after that matter, engaging in some domestic violence programming or another anger management program. And I'm sure that he was offered that through his probation agent. There could have been evidence that were submitted that he engaged in some of that while he was in custody. I think he was in prison, possibly, for that matter. He could have shown that he had done something to address the violent tendencies and the trauma that it causes on his family. and his children. And Mr. Dodd was also alluding to the fact that he was to, part of the case plan was to get a capacity to parent evaluation and assessment. And that did not happen because Mr. Payne and Mrs. Payne would not cooperate with the agency in working a case plan. Other than the visitation, it was late in the game that they signed any releases so that those referrals could be made. I don't know why they chose to do that, but they... Am I muted now? Oh, I'm sorry. I saw a hand that said something about unmuting. But they refused to cooperate until very, very late in the game. And then I would also address Ms. Walker's argument about the child coming back to the state of Minnesota and being removed immediately, whereas Minnesota statute requires that unless compelling reasons can be found, the county shall immediately file termination paperwork according to Minnesota statute 260C 503 subdivision 2 parent 4. And the county worked tirelessly to try to establish some compelling reasons that they would engage in programming, that we could resolve all of this. And they got nothing but argument at the agency where law enforcement had to be called. They were unwilling to work a case plan to show that there were compelling reasons. And thus, under the law, the county had no choice but to file an immediate termination petition. And had, going back to Ms. Payne and her and Ms. Walker's argument that she had no opportunities to rebut the presumption, she had multiple opportunities. She lost her children in the previous case that gave her the presumption of palpable unfitness before this case came to be. And at the time that that other termination was granted by the court, Ms. Payne was pregnant, and the agency knew that with Mr. Payne's child. They offered her multiple voluntary services under their pregnant moms program, and she refused to engage. She could have continued in her therapy, which she testified to, that she quit immediately after the former case closed. She had no desire to actually address the problem that violence demonstrated to children causes them severe trauma. She was willing to complete a capacity to parent, but once again, she would not sign the referrals. They had to go through her lawyer. They had to be checked out by them. They weren't signed. They weren't returned. There was nothing she could do to start a referral process until we got some paperwork agreeing that it was okay to do so. And the low bar, I agree, it's a low bar. Had Mr. Payne demonstrated that after his domestic assault conviction in 2019 that he had undergone some programming, it could have been prison programming, it could have been voluntary out of the home programming, anything to show that he had become palpably fit to parent a child because he has an understanding of violence in the family. He did not. Mrs. Payne also could have continued her therapy. She could have come to the understanding of how much trauma her other two children had gone through by living in a violent home that caused that termination. But she did not see a problem with it. She believes that as long as Mr. Payne is not physically abusing her in the 1 year that they have known each other, that there is no problem. And I do believe that it is important that Mr. Payne had an assault charge during the pendency of this CHIPS case and the TPR petition, because it shows that he still has violent tendencies. His previous capacity to parents that the other social workers testified to demonstrate that. And it is typical that a personality disorder does not correct itself. they're very, very difficult to correct a personality disorder. And these, unless he is willing and Mrs. Payne was willing to undergo some pretty substantial therapy, they have not overcome their burden of the low bar, proving that they can successfully parent a child without trauma. I cede the rest of my time.
Thank you for that argument. Any rebuttal by appellants?
Thanks, Your Honor. What my counsel and I decided to do would be to divide our 5 minutes 50-50.
Okay, very good. If you can just wait a minute while the marshal sets the clock, and hopefully you can see that in your grid view. I think the marshal will have it up in just a second here. There you go. Can you see that now, sir?
I can. Shall I proceed?
You may. Thank you.
Thank you. I guess what I want to bring up is just talk about the language of the JAK decision. What the court said, talking about the district court order there, is it does not reflect that the district court made a determination as to whether or not the mother's evidence would justify a finding of fact that she is not palpably unfit. The decision goes on to say that the district court order does not reflect the court made a determination whether or not JAK's evidence is sufficient to raise a genuine issue of fact as to palpable unfitness. The same problems exist here with this decision. The court simply didn't address that. So we have a circumstance where the trier of fact, in this case, doesn't address the specific factual issues that I think the JAK decision requires the court to address. That didn't happen. Nobody's made a determination. The court has not made a determination as to those questions. Does the evidence that was submitted rise to the level that it raises a genuine issue of fact? I think it does. I think it clearly does. We're talking about, in the case of my client, we're talking about a presumption that went into place 8 years before the hearing in this case. And during that time, he did address issues. There's no question about that. And his testimony, of course, is evidence. And the question of whether or not it raises a genuine issue of fact, seems to me it does. But the point is that was not addressed by the trial court. I think if JAK and RDL tell us nothing else, those issues at least need to be addressed. That didn't happen here. So I'll defer. That's all I had. I'll defer the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Walker, if you can just wait a minute while the marshal gets the clock set. You can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. As Ms. Tufts was appealing to the court, she was providing much of the testimony that was provided in court and making statements as though DMP did not address the facts as to whether or not she agreed whether abuse had an impact on children. That was not addressed in the court. That was not a fact before the court. That was not a fact that she proved that she would indeed have addressed these issues. She testified that she had addressed these issues. There is no proof that she had not addressed these issues.
Ms. Walker, if I can ask another follow-up question, just to clarify what it is that the introduced evidence has to relate to. Ms. Tufts argues that it has to show or justify some finding about the correcting whatever the problem had been in the previous case. But as I read JAK, parent seeking to rebut the statutory presumption needs to produce evidence to support a finding that, quote, the parent is suitable to be entrusted with the care of the child. Doesn't relate to the previous basis. And then in re welfare of child of JW and similar, even the DLD case says parenting abilities have improved. That's the point, whether parenting abilities generally have improved. So what do you think the evidence has to show when it comes to the introduction of evidence? Is it evidence that could support a finding that the basis for the previous termination has been corrected? Or is it evidence regarding parenting abilities generally? Or is it evidence regarding suitable to be entrusted with the care of a child?
I would believe that it would be the third, Your Honor. And I think that is exactly what we're asking the court to decide today, because I believe that the statute is a very strict statute. But then when you look at JAK and RDL, it assumes that it's a low bar, but their ability to parent a current child safely. And so what does that mean? Does that mean my client had to follow voluntary services prior to the birth of the child? Does that mean my client had to take additional classes even though she entirely completed case plan prior? Does that show that she needed to sign the case plan immediately even though she was following it? Does that mean that she must have shown up for every single supervised parenting time completely prepared? Does that mean that she had to not have married a man who had a less than perfect past when she herself had a less than perfect past that she was trying to overcome? What does that mean? Is she suitable to be a parent now? Is she capable of being a parent now? Those are the questions that must be asked and answered. And what is the bar that she needs to provide to show those things? And does she, in within less than 30 days of returning to the Minnesota and having a child taken away from her, what does she have to provide as evidence necessarily? How could she even provide evidence if the child's not even in her care? She's following a case plan, even though she hasn't signed one. Is that what that means? It's a low bar. So then,
Judge Cochran, I see that Ms. Walker's time is up, but I do have one more question. Would you indulge me and allow me to ask it?
Certainly.
So, Ms. Walker, assuming we agree with you that the standard wasn't followed in this case, you know, the standard articulated by the case law, what would the remedy be? Because what I'm hearing you argue is the remedy might be more time to rebut any presumption, and I don't know that the case law supports that. So what are you asking us to do?
Thank you, Your Honor. I don't know that the case law directly addresses that, which is part of the issue. And I believe that perhaps more time in a case like this would be appropriate, or even dismissing the CHIPS case altogether because it doesn't show that the child was ever in any harm. I don't believe the case law addresses either case. And of course, my client would prefer that we would dismiss the CHIPS case altogether and the termination case altogether. However, maybe more appropriate would to dismiss the termination case and allow both parties to go through their capacity of parent evaluation and have time with the child, maybe time with the child in person or anything other than 30 days of the county just arbitrarily making up its mind since there were previous cases and make an autonomous argument, ignoring the case law that it's a low bar for each party to show. And there are certainly circumstances where children were in more deleterious situations that the child goes back to the parents, even though they had previous case histories. In this particular situation, we're not talking drugs, we're not talking alcohol, we're not talking abuse. None of those situations are in the plate. We're not even talking about parents who have been ignoring therapy or ignoring additional time. We're talking about a particular situation where the parents weren't even allowed to show that they had corrected situations. But also, we are also asking that for a more directed case law regarding what is the burden between what the statute has stated and what JAK and RDL have stated as to what a parent actually needs to show to meet that low bar. And I think that's imperative as we approach additional cases where we're looking at terminations simply based on the fact that a parent has had previous terminations. And it seems to be arduous or even arbitrary as to the county or the human services particularly involved, and more direction would be appropriate.
Any further questions from the panel? I have one follow-up question. Do you have a standard that you would suggest in terms of what the parent needs to show? You said more direction would be helpful. What are you arguing that standard should be?
Well, pursuant to the case law, it is already a low standard.
Right. Right.
And so...
So in terms of what the parent needs to show, what are you suggesting that the rule of law be?
I'm suggesting that if a parent is able to show that they can parent and that they can keep the child safe and there is a modicum of safety for that child, then they should be provided the opportunity to show that they can continue to keep that child safe and not just arbitrarily. I digress. I can pontificate on this all day long. But a parent should be provided the opportunity to show that they can parent. And if they've shown the opportunity that they can parent and parent safely, the history in which they are determined, it should not just be something that every county can just usurp or turn upside down. There must be something more directing in what the standard is if a parent has a previous termination. And in this case, while the parents were frustrated with the county and angry with the county, they showed that they showed up for every parenting thing. There was no issues, even by the county, with how parenting took place. The only reason this child was taken away within 6 hours of returning to the state of Minnesota is because they had previous terminations. It wasn't based upon whether or not they could parent or they've changed their situation. And they weren't even provided the opportunity to provide that evidence as requested by the county.
Thank you for that answer.